Genesis 28 to 29:30, the 29th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on October 20, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Genesis chapter 28 to start with today. In this chapter, we'll see the beginning of a change in Jacob. It's interesting to see how this happens. We'll read the first part, Genesis 28, verses 1 through 9. So Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and from there take to yourself a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. And may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. May he also give you the blessing of Abraham to you and to your descendants with you, that you may possess the land of your sojournings, which God gave to Abraham." Then Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Paddan Aram to Laban, son of Bethuel, the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. Now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take to him a wife from there, and that when he blessed him, he charged him, saying, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." And that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to Paddan Aram. So Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan displeased his father Isaac. And Esau went to Ishmael and married, besides the wives that he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaioth. Last time we talked about that the end of the last verse, it says that Rebekah complained about the wives of Esau, kind of setting the stage, preparing the ground for this departure of Jacob and a reason for that departure. Now, it's interesting, it's hard to determine why it is that Isaac consents to sending Jacob away. Because if you'll remember, before, Abraham wanted Isaac to have a wife from the relatives in Haran. He didn't want him to marry a Canaanite. But he wouldn't send Isaac to go get a wife. He sent a servant to get a wife and bring that wife back, because he didn't want Isaac to leave the land that God had promised to Abraham and his descendants. But in this case, Jacob is leaving. So Isaac consents to sending him away from this land that's been given to him and his descendants. So why would that be? Well, there are a couple of possibilities. One is, it could be that Isaac is aware of the threat that Esau has made on Jacob's life. We know that Rebekah is aware of this threat. We know that Rebekah knows that Esau has said that as soon as Isaac dies, he's going to kill Jacob. It could be that Isaac is aware of this as well. And he knows, we know from last time that Isaac thinks he's on his deathbed. Death could come any time. And it could be that what Isaac is thinking is, I'm about to die. As soon as I die, there'll be no protection for Jacob. So we've got to send him. The other possibility is that Isaac thinks that this will be good for Jacob. that there is a sense in which him being forced to take this trip might help grow him up. It doesn't say either way, so we don't know exactly what's going on. In any case, he sends him away. But before he sends him away, Isaac blesses him. And this is significant for a couple of reasons. Before, Isaac had blessed him, but Isaac blessed him thinking that he was Esau. So there's a sense in which it's not a blessing freely and knowingly given. But now, this time, he knows to whom he is giving this blessing, and he gives it knowingly and freely to Jacob. So Isaac has come to the place where he acknowledges that Jacob is the one that God has picked to be the inheritor of the promises, and Isaac has reconciled himself to that fact. And now he puts his stamp of approval on the blessing. And what does the blessing consist of? Well, most importantly, it's essentially the blessing that had been given to Abraham and the one that was given to Isaac. And it is that the descendants of Jacob will occupy the land in which he is now living, and his descendants will increase beyond numbers. Okay. So Jacob then, after having received the blessing, Jacob is going to leave. Now the narrator talks about Esau's response to this. Esau has apparently made it the practice of his life to live in independence from his parents and in disregard of their values. He hasn't valued the promises that were given to Isaac and the ones that he, as firstborn, was likely to inherit. He gave them up easily. He didn't value them. Nor did he value his parents' perspective on who makes a suitable wife. If you'll recall, both Abraham and Sarah were adamant that Isaac not marry one of the Canaanite women. Esau must have known that. But in disregard of that, Esau went ahead and married local Canaanite women. And then after having married them, he should have known that that was a source of friction between him and his parents. But he does, there's no sense of concern about that until he realizes that his actions have alienated himself from his parents. It's only when he realizes that it cost him something, that is, his mother helped Jacob get the blessing that was due to him. So he knows now that the fact that he has alienated his parents has cost him something. So now he decides he's going to do something about it. And what he decides to do is marry someone who is not a Canaanite, marry a relative, that is, marry a descendant of Ishmael. What's interesting here is Esau is seeing his rejection of his parents' values as being a political problem rather than a spiritual problem. And he's addressing it by now he's going to marry someone who would be acceptable to them, rather than addressing it as a spiritual problem, and that is with repentance for his rebelliousness. Now the narrative picks up again with following Jacob. Let's read the next section, verses 10. Let's read all the way to the end of the chapter. Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and spent the night there, because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. And he had a dream. And behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your descendants. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place! This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on its top. And he called the name of that place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that thou dost give me, I will surely give a tenth to thee. Okay, Jacob takes off. Jacob, I think that what we are to understand is Jacob is anxious about this journey. I think that the anxiety is at least in part due to his brother's threat. It's not clear whether he has run from his brother in fear or not. There is a hint in the last chapter when it says that Rebekah sent for Jacob to tell him this plan, indicating that Jacob might have been in hiding, but it's not clear. In any case, Jacob takes off, and in the initial part of the journey, he stops at this place with no name, this place with no apparent significance, because he's run out of daylight, indicating that it might be possible that his concern is to get as far away from Esau as quickly as possible, and therefore didn't go to the nearest city. He just stops when he runs out of daylight. Now remember, Jacob is not the outdoorsman. Esau is the outdoorsman. This is apparently an adventure for Jacob, and I think that he is fearful. This is wild country, and we've seen that in past chapters of Genesis. This is kind of like the Wild West, and he's heading out into the unknown, a trip that he's never made. And he has a long ways to go. This trip is about a month-long trip. And he is leaving everything that is familiar and going out into this wilderness. So he's got to be feeling very alone and, I think, scared. He stops at a certain place. The word that's used for place can just mean a spot, or sometimes it's used in the sense of a holy place. So this word can mean either. In this instance, he thinks it's just a spot, but as it turns out, it's a significant spot. He lies down and he puts his head on a rock. It's hard to imagine sleeping well with one's head on a rock, but that's what he does. It's not surprising that he has a dream, I suppose. he has this dream. And in this dream, there's a vision of this stairway. This is the word that's used for stairway, only shows up here in the Bible, is the only place. But it's related to a word that means to throw up a mound, to put up a mound. So it's more likely that it's not a ladder, but rather a stairway built in the face of some mound going up. And on this stairway, we've got angels going up and going down, presumably in an orderly fashion. They're going up probably on the right-hand side, since they're probably American, and going down on the right-hand side. And at the top of, and it's stretching from the earth into heaven, and we've got, and God is standing at the top of this ladder in heaven. And in this vision, he proclaims a blessing on Jacob. He says, "I am the Lord God of Abraham and Isaac," indicating the continuity. I am the same God that appeared to Abraham, your grandfather. I am the same God who appeared to Isaac. And he gives him promises which echo the promises that had been given both to Abraham and to Isaac. In particular, your descendants will get the land that you are lying on. Your descendants will be numerous. And in you, all of the families of the earth shall be blessed. Those are all statements that were made to both Abraham and Isaac. But he goes on and he gives some other promises which are more personal, that are directed to Isaac in particular. He says, "I will keep you. I will bring you back to this land, and I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised." So those are a departure then from repeating the promises that have been given to Abraham and Isaac. And he's speaking directly to Jacob and saying, in this circumstance, I will take care of you. And that he will return to this place safely. It says that Jacob's response when he awakes is, he says, "Surely the Lord is in this place and I did not know it." That's interesting because he thought this was just any old place. This is where he went to sleep, and yet God appeared to him in this place. God showed up where he didn't expect to see him. That's interesting because that's kind of the story of Jacob's life. God's been very active behind the scenes in Jacob's life. It's just that Jacob has not had the eyes to see that. He's been oblivious to it. Okay, he then, after he gets up, he takes the stone, presumably the stone that he had used as a pillow during the night, and he stands it up. Apparently as if saying, this stone was a witness to what I saw. Let me stand it up as a way of remembering, a memorial to this event. And then he pours oil on it. And the pouring of oil on it, it's not clear what the significance of that is. But he wants this to be a way of remembering what God that God appeared to him and what God said to him. And he names the place Bethel, which means literally the house of God. And he says this is the house of God or the gate of God. It's interesting that this place actually has a history that apparently Jacob is unfamiliar with. When Abraham came to Canaan, when he first arrived, the first place in Canaan that he was, he built an altar and he made sacrifice to God. And then he moved further on and came to Bethel and built another altar and sacrificed to God there. So this was a place that was known to Abraham. This is a place where Abraham had built an altar. But Jacob apparently is not aware of that history. Jacob then makes a vow. And he says, if God will keep the promises that he has made, he will be my God. And this will be his house, and I will give one-tenth of all that I have to God in thankfulness for what he has done. Okay. Now some commentary on a couple of things in this section. The first is, what is the significance of this vision? We've got a stairway that stretches from earth into heaven with God standing at the top, and we've got angels going up and down on this stairway. Well, presumably this vision is capturing, it is putting into picture form some kind of route of communication between earth and God. And it's two-way communication. It's angels, which oftentimes are messengers, messengers going up and messengers coming down. So presumably what it's talking about is the possibility of communication or intercourse between God and man. God, and that implies then that God hears man. And that's significant to Jacob in his situation. Jacob is feeling alone and scared, and he's off on this journey, and he knows not what's going to happen. And there's a sense in which God has heard his distress, and God has responded to his distress. And I think that we see that in God's comments to Jacob because of those personal comments addressed to Jacob in particular, promising safety to Jacob. And I think that we are to understand that Jacob, there's some sense in which this stairway is pertinent to Jacob as a person. That Jacob is going to play some role in this unique opportunity of communication between God and man. And in particular, as we read on in the Old Testament, I think what this is foreshadowing is the development of the nation of Israel as a peculiar people selected by God to serve a peculiar function in world history. And that is a means by which God's revelation is communicated to the rest of the world, and a means by which the world, mankind, can address itself to God. And in particular, there's one person related to Jacob who most embodies this function, and that's Jesus Christ. If you look at John 1:51, Jesus has been making himself known to some of the disciples and selecting some of the disciples and asking them to follow him. And they do. And he makes the comment he's speaking to Nathanael at this point. Well, let's start with verse 49 of chapter 1 in John chapter 1. Nathanael answered him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Jesus answered and said to him, because I said to you that I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You shall see greater things than these. And he said to him, truly, truly, I say to you, you shall see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. This is apparently a reference back to this vision that Jacob had seen. And there's a sense in which Jesus is uniquely that gateway to heaven, that means by which communication goes to God and from God to man. Okay. Bethel, this place, becomes significant later in the history of Israel. We know archaeologically that this site had been a religious site for the Canaanites even before the time of Jacob. There have been remains found there archaeologically that indicate that this had long been a religious site. But in this account in Genesis, there's no hint that Jacob had any awareness of that at all. However, after the time of Jacob, this site continues to be very significant religiously. During the period of the Judges, the Ark of the Covenant was placed here at Bethel. And Phinehas, who was the grandson of Aaron, had a ministry here at Bethel. During the time of Samuel, we know that Bethel was a place of pilgrimage. During the time of Solomon, well, after the death of Solomon, when the northern kingdom developed, Bethel became the religious site of the northern kingdom. If you will recall, one of the concerns of the leaders of the northern kingdom was that if the people from the northern kingdom went down to Jerusalem every year, that it would undermine the authority of the rulers of the northern kingdom. So they wanted another place to which people could make their pilgrimages. And Bethel became that place. So Bethel becomes a rival site to Jerusalem. We know that during Elisha, that there was a school of prophets that lived here at Bethel. And we know that during the period of Hosea and Amos, Bethel became a place that was condemned by the prophets as being a rival to true religion. And then finally, Bethel was destroyed by King Josiah, king of Judah, after the northern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrians. King Josiah, during his reforms, finally has Bethel destroyed, and that's the last mention of it in the Old Testament. So this spot continues to have major significance throughout the history of Israel. What should we make of Jacob's oath at this point? It seems to me that this oath that he makes marks a dramatic change in Jacob. And by dramatic, I don't mean instantaneous, because the change takes place over a period of about 20 years. But Jacob does begin to change at this point. God has appeared to him just as he had done to Abraham and Isaac. And he blesses Jacob. Obviously, this is the blessing that counts. The blessing that he received from Isaac was incapable of bringing to pass. The promises that were made there could only be brought to pass by God. And now God is making those promises himself to Jacob. So this is the promise that really counts. This is significant. And he receives these promises without his cleverness. Jacob hasn't tricked God into this. God is freely and knowingly making these promises to Jacob. So that means Jacob is truly the inheritor of these divine promises, the thing that he had wanted from the very beginning. And yet these promises are made purely out of God's graciousness, not because of Jacob's cleverness. And God is giving him personal assurance of his safety on this trip. And that's apparently something that Jacob desperately wants is a sense that things are going to be okay, and God is responding to that. What's interesting is up to now, Jacob has this pattern of using trickiness and deceit in order to make sure that he gets what he wants, to make sure that he gets what he should have. He's grasping. That's his nature. When he was born, he was grasping the heel of his brother. What we've seen with Jacob is he will do whatever it takes to get what he thinks he has coming to him. Because if he doesn't look out for himself, who will? But what God is doing is coming to him and saying, I will guarantee your safety. What's interesting is that makes it possible for Jacob to cease to be a grasper. If God assures his safety, then Jacob no longer has to do his conniving and deceit to make sure that he's taken care of. There's a sense in which a freedom is granted to Jacob, and he understands that. So if all he has to do now is to trust the promises God has made, and he doesn't have to grasp. And what happens is we will see that Jacob comes to trust God. And as he comes to trust God, his character changes. And he's no longer the deceiver that he had been. He makes this oath. And many of the commentaries that I looked at see this as a bad oath, because we see him negotiating with God. There's a sense in which I think that's true, because this is not the kind of statement that you would expect to have heard from Abraham, that Abraham would make these promises to, or God would make these promises to Abraham, and Abraham would say, well, if you do this, this, and this, then they will be my God. That's not what we would have expected from Abraham. It is what we would expect from Jacob. He is still wheeling and dealing, in a sense. However, the deal that he makes is not as manipulative as the kinds of behavior we have seen from Jacob before. Essentially, what he is saying is, God, if you will do what you have promised to do, then you will be my God. Then I will serve you. In other words, it's basically the bargain. God, if you are who you say you are, and if you will do what you said you will do, then you will be my God. I will worship you. That's not a bad deal. That's essentially the deal that all of us make with God. That if God is who he says he is, and if he will do what he says that he will do, then we will serve him. That's not a bad deal, because God is more than happy to be who he is and more than happy to do what he's promised to do. So I think what we're seeing here is a significantly different Jacob. We're seeing a Jacob who understands that ultimately he has to trust God in order to make it through life. That no matter how tricky he is, he can't guarantee his success. His tricks could always fail. The only one who can guarantee him success is God. And God is committed to doing just that. So we see, I think, a change in Jacob at this point, and he begins to, that truth, that perspective on life begins to sink in, and he begins to understand it. Okay, let's read the next section where he meets his future wife. Let's see, let's do verses 1, how far are we going to go? 1 through 12. No, let's go 1 through 20. Then Jacob went on his journey. and came to the land of the sons of the east. And he looked and saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it. For from that well they watered the flocks. Now the stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would then roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. And Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where are you? Where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." And he said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know him." And he said to them, "Is it well with him?" And they said, "It is well. And behold, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep." And he said, "Behold, it is still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered. Water the sheep and go pasture them." But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are gathered and they roll the stone from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep." While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And it came about when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the mouth of the well and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. So it came about when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. Then he related to Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, "Surely you are my bone and my flesh." And he stayed with him a month. Then Laban said to Jacob, "Because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?" Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face. Now Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, "I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter Rachel." And Laban said, "It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. This is a great story, well told. Jacob arrives. He doesn't know exactly where he is, because when he meets these shepherds, he asks them, "Where are you from?" So it's not until they answer him that he knows that he has arrived at his destination. When he finds out that they are from Haran, he asks about Laban, because that's the family that he went to see. And they say, "Well, his daughter will be coming soon." And Jacob asks, "Well, why are you just standing around? I mean, you could be out pasturing your flocks." And they say, "Well, we have to wait till everybody gathers, and then we can move the stone to get water from the well." Well, Rachel comes, and as soon as Rachel comes, Jacob goes, and presumably they were waiting to move the stone because it takes several people to move this stone because it's so heavy. But Jacob, when Rachel comes, he goes and single-handedly moves this stone that otherwise requires several men to move. He rolls the stone away. The flocks are able to drink. Then he meets Rachel. He kisses her, and he begins to cry. And I think there's probably a sense of great relief. He has made it to his destination. It has probably been a long and lonely journey, but he has safely made it to his destination. There are a lot of parallels between this scene and the scene when Abraham's servant shows up in Haran. If you'll remember back a few chapters, the servant has been sent to find a wife for Isaac. And at the well, he meets Rebekah, who is the future wife of Isaac. Well, this has a lot of similarities, but one of the most striking differences is that Abraham's servant had arrived with a pack of animals, with 10 camels loaded with goods in order to negotiate a wife. Jacob shows up with nothing. Jacob is just there by himself. He has nothing to offer in exchange for his wife. Jacob is then, he goes to meet the family. He meets Laban, and he is taken in by Rachel's family and cared for. And he lives there a month, at which time then, presumably during that month, he's been working in the household. But Laban says, "Should you be working for nothing for me? It's not right that you be working and not receive anything for it. We need to have some kind of long-term arrangement." And so essentially the question is, what do you want to be paid for the work that you offer? And his reason for this is he doesn't want to take advantage of a relative, someone who is of his own flesh and blood, which becomes ironic later on because he very clearly does take advantage of his own flesh and blood. What Jacob says that he would like in exchange for his work is he would like to work for 7 years in exchange for taking Rachel as his wife. By all accounts, 7 years is a very healthy sum to be paying for a bride. So he's making a very generous offer here. Obviously, he doesn't want to be turned down. He wants his offer to be accepted. But Laban, being the kind of person that he is, files that away. Just as, by the way, Jacob, in response to Esau, who came in very hungry, wanted something very badly, Jacob took advantage of that. Here, Laban sees that Jacob wants something very badly, files that away. Here's something that can be taken advantage of. Also interesting with respect to Laban is his answer. Jacob says, "I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter Rachel." And Laban's response is, "It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me." Is that a yes or a no? He's left himself wiggle room. He hasn't responded directly to the offer. And he takes advantage of that wiggle room that he has left himself later. Jacob works gladly for the 7 years, and the time flies because he loves Rachel very much, and so it's well worth all of the time that he puts in. Okay, well, let's read verses 21 to 30. "Then Jacob said to Laban, 'Give me my wife, for my time is completed that I may go into her.' And Laban gathered all the men of the place and made a feast. Now it came about in the evening that he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and Jacob went into her. Laban also gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, 'What is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served with you? Why then have you deceived me?' But Laban said, 'It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one, and we will give you the other also for the service which you shall serve with me for another 7 years.' And Jacob did so and completed her week, and he gave him his daughter Rachel as his wife. Laban also gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maid. So Jacob went into Rachel also, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban for another 7 years." So Laban tricks Jacob. He takes advantage of him. The time of the marriage arrives, and Jacob says, "Give me my wife, for my time is completed, that I may go into her." He doesn't mention her name, interestingly, and Laban takes advantage of the situation. Laban substitutes Leah for Rachel. Presumably, it was customary for the bride to wear a veil until after the wedding was over, the whole wedding ceremony was over. And therefore, he was able to disguise Leah as Rachel. So Jacob thinks that he is marrying Rachel, but in fact is marrying Leah. Interestingly, this is a deception that is similar to what Jacob had done with respect to deceiving Isaac, pretended to be someone that he was not. And here we have another kind of similar deception. Jacob, the next morning when he finds out, he goes to Laban and he is outraged. "What have you done?" "7 years of service, and he's marrying off not one of his daughters, but two of his daughters." But Jacob receives it rather graciously. Rather than fight over the fairness of it, he acquiesces, and he works for the 17 years that Laban has required. But Laban has taken advantage of his own flesh and blood. Obviously, deceit runs in this family. It's a family trait. Laban is obviously a deceiver. He's a conniver. Rebecca, similarly, was a deceiver and a conniver. And Jacob, also a deceiver and a conniver. One of the things that is particularly, as I look at this passage, it is, on the one hand, it is wonderful to see Jacob's ability to cope with this situation without becoming outraged, without becoming hateful, as his brother Esau had become hateful. He doesn't say, "I'm going to kill you, Laban," for instance. But on the other hand, it seems to me that Leah is in a particularly difficult situation. I can't help but feel sorry for Leah. She is a pawn in this whole thing. And she has just been put in a very difficult situation that we see becomes more difficult as time goes on. Laban has created a dynamic that's fraught with problems. And we see that those problems work themselves out in the life of Jacob's family through the rest of Genesis, actually. But it is interesting that there's a sense in which history vindicates Leah. She is the mother of Judah, the tribe from which the kings of Israel come, and the tribe to which Jesus comes out of. And she is also the mother of Levi, who is the one from which the priesthood descends. So there's a sense in which history vindicates Leah. She has a very noble lineage that flows out from her. Okay. What's interesting here is Jacob begins this change in character. And I think that we will see as time goes on that Jacob becomes a different person. He learns to trust God for his welfare. And by trusting God for his welfare, he no longer has to be the grabber, the deceiver that he had been. And he does indeed change. He begins to look at things differently and no longer is grasping to make sure that he gets what he deserves, but is willing to settle for injustice even, because he doesn't have to worry about it ultimately. God will take care of things. And we will see him develop over the next few chapters further in that direction. Questions or comments on this section?
Perhaps I've misread this passage my whole life, which is not out of the realm of possibility. Mm-hmm. When Laban says, complete the week of this one, and we will give you the other also for a service which you shall serve for another 7 years. I guess I always took that week to be figurative for the 7 years, and that Jacob didn't get Rachel until after 14 years.
Yeah.
But is that not?
My understanding is that traditionally there is the wedding week. There's a wedding week in which there are continued festivities, and presumably what's happened here is Laban says, let her complete the week, let her have her week of being the bride, and then you can marry Rachel in exchange for another 7 years. So I think what's happening here is he marries Leah, when that week is over, then he marries Rachel, and presumably she has her week, and then he is obligated, though, to serve out another 7 years.
Thank you.
This is slightly tangential, but when he was sleeping and had this dream, this vision of God, he doesn't pull the Moses thing where he says, like, take off your shoes, you're on holy ground. And it makes me wonder, we have so many weird things about this holy ground and this sacred object and whatnot, but that's not the way God treats it. And why would God tell Moses to take off your shoes and literally touch the holy ground? And then later he tells the priest, well, don't touch this, it's holy. Mm-hmm. Right, just the opposite. And here, neither thing happens. It's just like, well, this isn't real. This is just a dream. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. And there's no response to the place by God, though there is by Jacob.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what to say. This is a vision as opposed to Moses in the desert. That's not a dream, as I recall. I mean, the burning bush is where he told them to take off your sandals, you're standing on holy ground. So that may be part of it. Is your question, is there truly holy ground?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
Jacob memorializes this place with a pillar, mm-hmm. But Moses apparently didn't do anything
right
to the spot where there was the burning bush.
Right. Right.
And I just, with your theology being the land you walk on over there, it seems to me that any significant event in the history of the people of God, God would have said, okay, mark this spot, because mm-hmm. I want your sons and grandsons and great-grandsons to be able to come to this spot and be told this story. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't, mm-hmm. always, mm-hmm. sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I really don't know how to answer your question, but God does apparently make some things
and some places holy for a specific purpose and for a specific time. I mean, Jerusalem is a significant city. There's a sense in which Jerusalem is a holy city. It is a significant city. God has set it apart to serve a special purpose in history. The Ark of the Covenant was a holy object, and God enforced that. If someone touched it illegitimately, they died. So God has selected things to make holy things, but I think it's primarily for didactic purposes for a period of time. And even this holy place, like you say, they lift up these stones. It's largely to help them to remember what God has done. History is extremely important to the nation of Israel and to what God is doing in general. And so there are a lot of things that are designed to help us to remember our past, remember what God has done. And though there are a number of instances where he does that, that memorials are raised in order to help us to remember, well, to help the people of Israel, but ultimately us as well. But are there holy places that are inherently holy on the earth? I don't know.
I'm just following up on that question. I was wondering about the difference being that when God comes to Moses in the burning bush, he says an angel of the Lord was there, so that the presence of the Lord was there. And with the temple and the Ark of the Covenant, same thing, that the presence of the Lord was there. And that's the difference, perhaps, in that with Jacob's vision, it was a vision, not the presence of the Lord coming down to earth. And then with the coming of Christ, it's our bodies that are the temple. His presence resides in us. So we are the holy. It's not that there's a holy place, but that our bodies are the holy place wherein the presence of the Lord resides. Mm-hmm. Is that?
Possibly.
So you mentioned that there were previous events happened at Bethel before this.
Yes.
Could you elaborate on that?
Well, one is Abraham. Abraham raised an altar up there. That's one of the places that's mentioned in, I think it's in Genesis chapter 14. I'm not sure. But Abraham builds an altar there and worships God there. But then archaeologically it has been determined that Bethel, or at least in that area, was a Canaanite holy site that predates even Abraham.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about, the archaeological stuff.
And apparently it continued to be a holy site for the Canaanites even after the time of the patriarchs.
Just in case Logan and I wanted to go there, where is it?
Well, it's about 10 miles north of Jerusalem. I think you take Highway 5 and turn left.
You mentioned that kind of the vision perhaps might represent kind of a communication between God and man.
Yeah.
I'm wondering also, maybe in addition to that, if God was kind of revealing to Jacob that said, hey, you know, I've got angels, I send them down there to do something, they accomplish their task, they come back. And it's like, I've been working in the background this whole time in your life to get things done the way I want them done. And it's like, you should learn to trust that because I'm kind of in control of kind of your destiny anyway. So I just want to show you kind of what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible, do you think?
Well, it's possible. That's certainly one of the themes that we see being developed in Genesis, is that God is very active in all these things that are happening. That we as humans think that we are the ones pulling the strings and making things happen, but in fact, God is behind it, bringing about his purposes in his own ways. That is unquestionably one of the major themes that gets developed in Genesis, and that becomes really apparent in the Joseph story. And could that be part of what's being captured by this imagery and this vision? I think that's possible. But I think at the heart of it is this concept that there is this, that man is linked to God, or can be linked to God in a sense. That there can be this, there is this opportunity. He calls it the gateway to heaven. So that indicates that there are some places where there's not an opening, but at this place there is an opening. And an opening or an opportunity, there's the possibility of this kind of communication between God and man.
Just a little side note, one of the Jewish traditions today is that they require the groom to see the bride before the wedding, yeah. Based on this passage.
Yeah. Anything else? One more.
This is coming from an American culture, mm-hmm. but it seems like he's marrying his cousin. Mm-hmm. And was that very common in those days then?
I don't know whether that was common or not. But at this point, it has not been prohibited. Mm-hmm. It's not until we have the Mosaic Covenant. And I'm not sure exactly what the Mosaic Covenant prohibits, but some degree of closeness is out of bounds. But that had not been yet given. Whether it was common or not, I don't know. Okay, thanks.